Welcome to Flowcast. I'm Sister Beth Murphy. It was my privilege to sit in on this conversation between Sister Marceline Cook, justice promoter for our congregation, the Springfield Dominicans, and Heather Miller, who is Director of Tribal Relations and Historic Preservation at the Illinois State Museum in Springfield. Faithful Flowcast fans will recognize Heather's name. She joined us last year for an episode of Flowcast and is back again to continue sharing her knowledge about and commitment to honoring the lives and histories of the Native people who call Illinois home. She and Sister Marceline share fond memories of Heather's colleague, Cinnamon Caitlin Legutko. Cinnamon was the director of the Illinois State Museum from 2019 until her untimely death in January of this year. She hired Heather in the fall of 2022 for the responsibility of tribal relations for the museum. Heather and Sister Marceline talk about that and much more as they articulate why it matters that we learn about and learn from the Indigenous people of our state. For we Dominican sisters, it's a matter of fulfilling our commitment to renounce our participation in the sin of racism and reject the societal barriers created by the misuse of power, a commitment we made during our 2019 general chapter. So enjoy. I'll be back on the other side.
Welcome, Heather. It's a delight to have you join us again. I really learned so much from you last year. Last year, we also had the honor of having Cinnamon with us. That's Cinnamon Caitlin Legutko, who was the director of the Illinois State Museum. Sometime after the podcast was recorded, Cinnamon passed away. Having met and heard her, I could sense the loss of her presence and her vision for the museum. I'm sure you still feel the loss, Heather.
We sure do. It is really a pleasure to be back here with you all. And as you said, Cinnamon was a huge part in my work and especially the work of the museum. It's been a little bit of a challenge getting through the transition without her, but at the same time, we see the inroads that she made at the museum. And so I still feel her presence regularly. And my coworker and our current interim director who's taken her place, Jen Edgington, and I, we always comment that every time we see a cardinal, we really believe that that's Cinnamon in spirit. So she's around quite a bit.
That's really thoughtful. Thank you for sharing that. Now, since we talked about land acknowledgement last year, I'd like to begin with the land acknowledgement that we use for where we are right now. We are speaking to you from Springfield, which lies in the portion of land that has only recently been given the name Central Illinois, but was far longer home to the Cahokia, Kaskaskia, Michimagamia, Tamaroa, Kickapoo, Peoria, and some six other nations who made up the Illini peoples. From our study, Heather, that's what we have, you know, tried to learn. Who were the ancestors here? Is there something or someone missing from our acknowledgement?
I think that is a great start for sure. I know land acknowledgements are always important conversations with folks, but I always like to point out that oftentimes in our best interest to do something impactful, we don't always get it right. And that's okay. We're always still learning, and it's important to acknowledge that we're always learning. In land acknowledgements like that, you know, we're mixing some histories, we're giving some big picture information that doesn't really give a complete picture of what we're talking about. So, you know, it's getting there, and we're getting close, and I feel the importance of what you all are trying to do with those statements. But again, just a more attention to detail about how we're addressing certain time periods and who would have been involved in those time periods is important to think about. So briefly, you know, the Cahokia folks would have turned into some of those tribes that you acknowledge also in that land acknowledgement. They would have been the ancestors of the Peoria and some of the other nations that you mentioned. So that's what we're looking at. We need to give a little bit more attention to some of the details and the timeline with the folks that we're talking about in that land acknowledgement. But it's a great attempt, and it's certainly addressing the folks that have always called this area home and actually continue to live here.
Well, thank you. And we will continue to work on that, because study is important to us, and we want to know how we can carry this forward and bring out truth. So to begin our conversation today more fully, would you tell us about yourself and then your work at the museum? Because that is really an interesting piece.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for that. So many folks don't know this, but I'm American Indian. I am an enrolled citizen of the Wyandot Nation, and that nation currently resides in Oklahoma, Indian Territory. Our history, though, we did not start out in Oklahoma. We too are a tribe that faced lots of forced removals and had to move to certain locations. Our original homelands are up in the Canada area, and now we live in Oklahoma. So as you can tell, that's a long distance apart. So we had quite the journey to make to get down to those places, but our even further homelands, our original territory, lies in the mounds in Ohio, in Hopewell area. So those are who our ancestors really stem from and come from. So that's what I bring to the table with my work. My position at the Illinois State Museum is our first ever director of tribal relations and historic preservation. I work with our collections at the Illinois State Museum, which house and we caretake bodies and some of the pieces of burials associated with those ancestors that I was talking about and that you mentioned in your land acknowledgement even. So I get to work with those ancestors on a really regular basis. But I also work with the tribes who are related to those ancestors, and I get to make sure that we at the museum are doing right by the folks who are alive and still related to those ancestors that we caretake on our shelves, making sure that their wishes are done in the best way possible, and that we're being as respectful as we possibly can to ensure the final resting and safety and security of those folks that we caretake in the interim until we get them back in the ground.
So part of your work is being able to return the ancestors to the tribes?
It is. That's a humongous part of my work. We at the museum are a federally funded institution, and that means that we have some federal laws that are very applicable to what we do. One of those laws in particular is called NAGPRA. That's been in the news a lot. And NAGPRA stands for the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And so that says that any institution that takes federal money and maintains ancestors and their possessions and their collections are required to consult with tribal nations in order to make sure that those ancestors and their possessions are getting returned, are getting repatriated. That's what that means. And so that's my job, to help facilitate all of that. So yes, I get to work quite a bit with actually making those returns and getting people reconnected with their modern day ancestor or with their modern day relatives.
So I'm just thinking, as you're talking about that, how has that worked during this past year? Like, I don't know if you want to say, have you been able to return ancestors to the tribes so that they can be given proper burial with the tribal people?
Yeah, we've had a few successes this year. We've had a few projects that we've worked on to make that happen. And those have been really awesome to see us working through. But we had a couple of issues here in the state that we had to address first. One of the issues that we had here in the state is that we don't have any Native tribes that have any federally recognized land here in the state. So there are no official federally recognized tribes with a land base in the state. We're one of 16 states that has this issue. And so oftentimes our laws don't really think about how we need to work with tribal nations. So I've had the opportunity then to work with several of our tribal nations around helping edit and recreate some of the state laws. One in particular was the Human Remains Protection Act within the state of Illinois. We call it the burial law for short. And so what that means is that anytime remains are found, human remains are found by the state, we have to now engage with tribal nations through a process called consultation. So now we're required to do this. And that means that we get those nations that have a connection to whoever is accidentally found in these situations, we get them connected and we bring them to the table and we all have a discussion about what we do next and how do we take care of this in the right way. So I get to be engaged in those conversations. For things that we already have on our shelves, again, we're working with those tribal nations to make sure that their wishes are being completed. And now we have the ability through this new burial law to create places that the state owns that are solely for the reburial of Native American ancestors and their belongings. We couldn't do that before we made changes and edits to the burial law, and that was all given to us through consultation with the tribal nations that I get to work with. That was one of my very first jobs that I started with, and Cinnamon helped lead. So now I also see the completion and the signing and this passage of this brand new burial law in tribute to Cinnamon and to the hard work that she really wanted to see us complete. And so it's been amazing to see that law get changed and rewritten in the last year. And all because Cinnamon worked with our tribal nations, we got consultation, we brought their ideas to the table, and we were able to help change the state law then to really take care of the wishes of those tribal nations who are connected to the ancestors and, you know, really guide the work that I do at the museum.
How interesting. There's a couple of things you said that I want to touch into. And one that I didn't, until we started our own study, there's no federally recognized land or tribe in Illinois. And what I learned is, that's because the erasure of our indigenous people was complete.
Absolutely.
No one was left here. And you said there were 16 states that have that.
I believe so. It's 13 or 16. I should have checked before.
Well, that's whatever numbers.
So yeah.
That's always been striking to me, because our neighbors, we have Minnesota, Wisconsin. You know, we know of other states that are around us. And then you mentioned that you are creating places now. They don't make up for that erasure for sure, but you are creating places that are specifically for ancestral remains. That to me sounds like a significant piece.
It's huge. We're giving tribes the opportunity to say, you know, where they'd like their ancestors reburied. You know, we know that these are folks who called this place home for time immemorial, and they don't want to go to places like Oklahoma, that's now Indian territory. You know, they never were really there. They were here. They want to stay in the ground here. And so this law gives us the opportunity to make good on that wish and that desire by tribal nations. So it does, it feels really amazing to say we have done this work. It was directed by our tribal partners, and we're being able to fill a need that our tribal community told us was really important to them. And that's the most exciting part for me.
I can see it would be, because that's who you are and what you are about. So that's important. You've mentioned Cinnamon's leadership a number of times, and I know that her work was centered around decolonizing museums. And I remember I had never heard that term until I met her and knew of her work. I'm just wondering, you're doing it in one way. Are there other ways that that goal of decolonizing the museum is being carried on?
I definitely think so. We are really looking at different ways to bring in all types of communities to the museum. And Native communities are not the only folks who have been impacted by, I'm just going to say racist collection policies and racist elements that allow for these structures to operate. African American communities have also been impacted by museums and by institutions participating in, you know, what I like to call racial science, where people were measuring brains to determine, you know, that one group of people was quote unquote inferior, which is just not true. None of that is true. And we know that. But yet these institutions like museums and libraries and institutions or universities did this kind of work. So we were complicit in that history. But now's the time for us to figure out the right ways to change that and to do right by communities. So that is bringing their perspectives into the museum. It's finding places where they can tell their own stories. It's providing spaces for their leadership and for their guidance when it comes to sharing information that is very special and important to them. And so that legacy of Cinnamon is continuing. You know, we're working very closely with our Latin community here in Springfield. We're trying to find different ways to engage our African American communities. We're trying to be just like her and follow in her footsteps in terms of all of this work. So yes, I do see it continuing, and it's having its impact as we move forward in this new world without her.
That I'm just really pleased with your work. And you mentioned something about racist elements, policies that allowed, in a sense, to dominate others and to erase or diminish others in some way. That reminds me, I want to bring up what is known as the doctrine of discovery. Mm. It was in the 1400s and 1500s that was during the time of exploration, that there were really church-endorsed concepts, and it gave explorers a moral and legal right to claim lands that they explored, no matter that there were indigenous persons already living on those lands. And that's part of the whole racism piece. But in doing that, they just failed to recognize the inherent human rights. I'm going to go back on that sentence. In doing that, they most certainly failed to recognize the inherent human rights of indigenous peoples. And so all of those concepts really were embedded and became known as the legal and political doctrine of discovery. And I think it's interesting. I heard of this case. It was in 1823. The United States Supreme Court employed that principle, the principles around this, in a land dispute here in Illinois, no less. It was between two men, Johnson and McIntosh. They were both claiming ownership of land along the Wabash River. Johnson said that he purchased the land from the Piankenshaw Nation. But the court ruled against Johnson because the tribe couldn't sell what it did not own. And I use own in quotes. McIntosh, on the other hand, did have the right to the land because it was sold to him by the U.S. government, which, of course, had taken it from the Piankenshaw Nation. Now, that whole case continues to be cited as a precedent in land disputes around the world, in the U.S. in 2005, I think it was, and in Canada as recently as 2011. So, you know, this doctrine, it really is a, quote, a doctrine of the church, but there was certainly complicity in it. And this year, on March 30th, 2023, the Vatican released a statement repudiating it. So I bring this up because we need to know the history of events that have a bearing on what is happening today. And I'm sure you see the effects of this doctrine and its impact in your work.
Absolutely. I see it in all the ways that we're talking about what I do and even the structure of society. I mean, that doctrine really helps shape stereotypes and even the images of American Indians that we have today. And so it's a constant impact. It's a constant reminder of some of the structures that are important to recognize and then take action and work towards changing how they impact and affect our world today.
You know, there's a saying that where you stand determines what you see. So if we only stand in one little place, our vision is pretty limited. But I also like to add, what you see determines where you stand. And so as we listen and learn about your work and see more broadly, we can come to stand in different places. We can have different ideas. We can broaden our perspective. I think of our prayer because that's important to us. It can expand to include those we might not have thought about, or it can expand how we pray. You know, I remember being taught, and this is many years ago, I was taught the three-step prayer by Sister Jose Habde, who was a Seneca elder. That was really special. And anytime I use it, I always acknowledge her because she taught it to us and asked us to share it. But I don't share it on my own. It's because she gave me permission to do so. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing that we're working on, it has to do with how we can live more sustainably. So I'm really conscious of, and I hope others are too, and inspired by Native people's love and relationship to Earth. And I'm sure you can speak to that as how that's important in our world.
Yeah, I think that's such a great question and a great way to bring all this together. I think we could even refer back to the doctrine of discovery here too, with thinking about this. One of the tenets that was used to dehumanize Native people was actually that land-based relationship. Folks thought that because Native people were so connected to the land that actually made them inferior. They weren't, you know, able to use the same technology or capable of thought to make technological advances. But that's just absolutely ridiculous in my opinion, because having an understanding and a true connection to the way that, you know, all these different elements of the world interact with one another. To me, that is knowledge. That's power. That's the ability to really harness technology and create different solutions for yourself. Understanding the way that a bee dances in order to feed itself and to carry on its community and tell a story about all of its adventures. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And if you are that connected to the land that you understand what's going on and the language that is being expressed by that bee and that dance, that to me is power. That to me is saying, you know things. Being able to build mound structures in the way that created calendars and would rotate and would follow the moon cycle as it progressed over what we now call a calendar year. To me, that is incredible technology and beyond understanding of not only, you know, our local world, but then the world above us that, you know, we can't necessarily reach every day, but through study and observation and being that connected with the land and having that intimate relationship with the sky and the sky world. I mean, that to me just screams understanding and an advanced ability to process and to make things. And that's what Native people did. That was, you know, our contribution. And that's how we created this place that now is home to all of us. And so those are the pieces that I think should be celebrated. So rather than seeing this as the doctrine of a discovery, let's call this an adventure in fact finding or an adventure in truth telling. It's a way to understand the way that we're all connected and the way that all of our contributions to this world that we now live in, you know, are impacted and how we can really harness our relationship with not only each other, but the plants and the animals and the area that we live in order to make sure that we take care of each other and to provide for one another.
Thank you. That was beautiful what you just said. And you reminded me as you were talking, and you mentioned that about the bee, our committee was reading a book. We read books together and talk about them. It was one called Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. I learned so much from her in that book on how to relate and how to, you know, thank the lettuce for giving its life for me, or thanking the apple or the fruit or the vegetables or whatever, that they provide life for us, or even the animals that provide life for us. So thank you for that. This has been a wonderful conversation. Is there anything that you would like to say in closing for it?
I'll say Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass is also one of my favorite books. And for our younger viewers, she just recently released the Young Readers edition of that. And so she's got her children's or her youth edition now. I've not had the opportunity to read that one, but I bet it's equally as excellent as her adult version. So I'll just add that because our next generation should also know the importance of that land-based knowledge. And I'm so glad that you're a fan of hers as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're so grateful for your joining us and more grateful for the work that you do.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure. I hope we get to do this again next year.
Thank you, Heather Miller and Sister Marceline Cook, for that touching and sensitive conversation. Now is the time, as you said, Heather, to bring the perspectives, tell the stories, and value the leadership of Illinois' Indigenous people. In the show notes for this episode, listeners will find plenty of resources to broaden their understanding of Indigenous Illinois. Please check it out at flowcastlisten.org. There you can also subscribe to Flowcast so every episode lands in your inbox. A big thanks to my colleagues Jean Ann Miller and Brandon Durham, who help bring every Flowcast episode to life. The Flow in Flowcast is an acronym for the life of the world, reminding us of our call to imitate Christ, who offered himself for the life of the world. Until next time, I'm Sister Beth Murphy. Thank you for joining us, and God bless.